Now, a man of many talents is the best way to describe my next guest, as well as being an airline pilot, a radio host and a world-class fencer. He's also a rock star with one of the most iconic and distinctive voices in the music industry. With a career spanning over 30 years, I've been chatting to Bruce Dickinson, the lead singer of Iron Maiden, on the release of his autobiography titled What Does This Button Do? Bruce Dickinson, a very iconic individual voice. When did you first realise that you could sing like that?
I didn't realise I could sing like that until I was at university, and even then it took me a while to sort of develop the pipes, as it were. And I ended up in a studio a few times with different producers who all got their mitts on me and taught me a few things as well. Yeah, it took me a few years, I suppose, to develop the racket that I make now.
It's quite different from a lot of other singing styles. Is it difficult to maintain that in terms of your voice, your throat, and staying healthy and able to sing in the first place?
Well, first of all, I'm used to it. I mean, I understand how physical it is, but my voice has always been fairly loud, and that's just kind of the way you're built. So I know that there's a lot of singers now, you know, they've got these really nice little, you know, in-ear things, and they sing like church mice. But it sounds really big. It's all warbly and everything else like that. But I am unfortunately, I'm old school. I'm a bit of a belter. When I first started singing this way, I couldn't do it. And I had to work at it and figure out how to do it. And now I kind of relax into it. I ease into it gently and then start pushing once you've warmed things up.
So you don't walk around your house then when you're making a cup of tea or making dinner and warming it up that way, shouting and yelling and singing in the house?
I do sometimes, but I have to wait till everybody else is gone, because I'm still kind of embarrassed about hearing my own voice when it's not like full on warmed up and cracking and ready to go, you know. So I don't like, I'm still a bit shy. Yeah,
I assumed after so many years, and you've done, in terms of your voice, you've done radio as well, TV, there's a whole list of things, I would have assumed that by now you'd be very confident and comfortable in your skin and your voice, knowing who you are.
Yeah, but not when it sounds rubbish. which everybody's voice sounds rubbish at some point during the day.
I was reading through the list of things that you've done and that you do. You're a very busy man. You know, obviously there's a rock star element. You're a pilot, a motivational speaker. You like a bit of fencing, and I'm putting it very mildly when I say that. But why then did you decide you wanted to write a book and put more pressure on yourself there as well?
You know, it's really strange. I didn't feel any pressure when I was writing the book. I was really enjoying it. In fact, I wrote about half the book. I wrote in the pub.
And so, you're my kind of man, Bruce.
Yeah, well, I did. I mean, I used to go down my local, and I handwrote it on, you know, A4. So I went, used to go down the pub and I'd have, you know, a couple of beers and make them last for about, you know, 2-3 hours, because I'd be busy scribbling away.
I asked that question, Bruce, and to be honest, when I started reading the book, I was drawn in from the first couple of pages. And one line, I'm not going to read it all out to spoil it for people, of course. You were talking about your work as a pilot and flying into Russia and waiting to land. And this is what made me think this is going to be an interesting read. You say here, to negotiate, I had a radio, an old Nokia mobile phone, and incredibly, it got a signal halfway round each holding pattern. I could text our airline operations, who would talk to Moscow via the British Embassy. No sat phone, no GPS, no iPad, and no Wi-Fi, because they wouldn't let you land. And I thought, it does sound like a James Bond novel. Has your life really been that exciting?
I suppose it has been quite exciting, and I really, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's not in the book that we didn't put in there that I think is really exciting. But the editor was like, you know, we've got all these great airline stories. I said, well, there's a whole bunch more, you know. There's the one about the monkey in the wardrobe. Which is just save that for book two, you know.
I was also, you know, when I was reading off about you. There's a long career in terms of your time in Iron Maiden. You left it, you came back, a huge solo career, as well as the radio stuff that we've already mentioned. I think there's a perception that life in show business and in rock and roll is all roses. It's fun. It's entertaining. It's easy. Was it a difficult life being in the middle of that storm for so long?
Well, I think everybody who's ever had to, you know, live out of a suitcase away from home for, in our case, years on end, for about 3 years on end, is going to have some fairly ambivalent feelings about it at one time or another. I mean, looking back, you go, wow, how amazing was that? You know, because you get a sense of perspective. But, you know, at the time, you know, you haven't had any sleep for 2 days. You've been living on a tour bus and, you know, you need a wash and your clothes need a wash and everything. You know, everybody gets a bit grumpy. But, you know, step back for a minute and go, wow, what an amazing experience, you know. So the book is a combination of talking about moments like that when it's talking about the whole music thing. I mean, again, Maiden, we have a fabulously long career for a rock band, and it shows no sign of going away, and it's not going to go away anytime soon. You know, it's not like this is not. I haven't written this book because I'm planning on stopping singing or any nonsense like that. One of the things I discovered as I was writing it was that all the most interesting things that happen to you in your life tend to be the first things that happen to you. You know, I mean, so the first time I headlined Reading Festival was like, wow. You know, first time you headlined Donington, wow. I don't know how many times we've headlined Donington now, quite a few. But somebody says, oh, you're going to headline Donington. You go, oh, cool.
So given these huge things you've done and achieved, whether it's performing in front of a huge crowd or in a certain venue, once you've done that once, are you always chasing that high, that thrill, that achievement again, trying to top it the next time?
Well, you're a bit stuck because it's always going to be a little bit kind of like that movie Groundhog Day. You know, there's always a little bit of a sense of that. I mean, when I got done with my first big tour with Maiden, which is the first one I did, the Number of the Beast tour, we went everywhere in the world. I'd been on a school trip. I'd been on a school trip camping, and I'd been on a sail training trip and ended up in Cherbourg and Alderney. And apart from that, I'd never hardly been abroad at all. And when I was in Samson for 2 years, we never toured outside the UK. I mean, we never even got across to Northern Ireland or, you know, or the Republic of Ireland, you know. So we were entirely encased within the mainland, you know, UK. And suddenly in Iron Maiden, I've got a number one album. I'm touring, headlining Europe. I'm touring the States. I'm touring Canada and Japan. And I'm like, wow, what's left? I mean, it's just like every single dream I ever had under the bedclothes as a 16-year-old adolescent, you know, has just happened to me.
And did you realise at the time how big it was? Or, you know, sometimes when we're in the middle of something, we don't always appreciate it, and we maybe do more so when we look back and reflect on it.
No, you're in it, and you do realise it's pretty big because, you know, you're on telly and things, and you're thinking, wow, this is like pretty pinch yourself. This is all happening, you know. And then the next thing, we're going out, we're doing an album in the Bahamas, and I'm thinking, this is proper rock star stuff here. You know, how did I end up doing this? But at the same time, there was a bit of me that went, you're going to lose your mind doing this if you don't have something which is not this world.
And what did you mean by that?
Well, I needed something else to do that was nothing to do with the world of rock and roll, of music, of being surrounded by people who told you were great or wanted to pull your pants down or wanted to give you drugs or all that stuff that goes around it. It's all peripheral. I mean, nothing core to the band and nothing really relevant to the music. But, sorry, you're in North America, and North America in the 80s was a wild and wacky place. In fact, the 80s period just about everywhere was pretty full on in terms of hedonism. And I was like, you know, I can see where this is all going, because you only have to look round and go...
was it then? Where did you turn? Is that when you decided that flying or
no,
fencing?
I already dusted off my fencing kit and thought, you know what? That's something which it requires discipline and precision, and I'm going to take my kit with me on the road. And so I did. And I just used to disappear off. And I had it was pre-internet. So you used to I used to carry the something called the official airline guide with me, which had all the flights every month from anywhere to anywhere in North America. And I'd just go, oh, yeah, I can get that time in the morning. And right, I'll whoosh and I'd whiz off and go somewhere for a couple of days and disappear.
You mentioned that you've no plans to slow down and to take a step away from music, although of course you did have to in 2014 when you got tongue cancer.
Yeah.
Is that something that completely changes your life, given what you do for a living?
Yeah. No, it doesn't completely change your life. It could have changed my life completely, you know, had I not been able to sing for whatever reason. I mean, there was a really nice phrase that my radiation oncologist used, who was the one responsible for getting rid of it, basically. He said, I've replanned your treatment a couple of times now. And he said, and there's a natural anatomical plane that I can shoot the radiation through, which means it'll avoid your larynx.
Right.
I went, wow, doc, you is the man, you know.
How did you first realise that something was wrong? Was it a pain, a lump, or what did you notice?
A lump in the side of my neck, just sort of. Just slightly above where my Adam's apple. Well, but basically, it was a lymph node, gland in my neck that was swollen.
Did you suspect cancer at any point, or was it not?
Yeah, I after a short period of time when I thought this is a bit strange, and it didn't develop into a cold or flu, and there were a couple of other small symptoms as well. You know, there was a tiny flecks of blood when I cleaned my teeth. There was a horrible smell coming from deep down in my throat. I thought, I've never smelled anything like that before in my life. It smells like something's dead. What's going on? And so I Googled it all, and I came up with the diagnosis of...
Dr. Google. Surely that's the wrong thing to do. You're not scaring yourself.
Of course it is. Yeah. No, I scared myself and because I came up with exactly the right diagnosis.
Given going back to the fact that you do what you do, did you ever at any point think this is going to be the end of my ability to sing? I'm going to have to stop what I do.
There was always a possibility that would be the case, but that doesn't stop you trying to get rid of it. As it happened, I was halfway through recording the Book of Souls album, and I Googled, Dr. Google came along, and I diagnosed myself as having squamous cell carcinoma of my throat, and quite possibly it was due to a human papilloma virus infection, because it turns out that there's an epidemic of human papilloma virus cancers in men aged over 40. And I just like in fit, healthy men over 40, I should add. So you just have a look there and you think, that's me. I fit exactly the profile, right age, right everything, bam, 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 bam. And I thought, yeah, it's a possibility. And I thought, well, ignore that. Obviously, you're a Google hypochondriac. Put that computer away and just get on with recording the album. And then when the last day of finishing the album, we'd just done the mix for Empire of the Clouds, put it all to bed, and I went down to the studio reception. I said, do you have access to a doctor? They went, yeah, we've got a local guy. I said, could you ask him to pop round the studio, please? And local French guy, we were recording in the album in Paris. And the guy came round, and he didn't speak much English, but he was a really good doctor. And he just had a feel around, had a look down my throat, and he went, okay, he said, here's some antibiotics in the unlikely event that that's an infection. And he said, you need a CAT scan of your... you need a chest x-ray, you need a CAT scan of your head and neck, and you need an MRI of whatever that lump is. I went, okay, does not sound like it's a sore throat then. So I went back to England, saw my GP in England, and within a week I was in front of the ear, nose and throat specialist, who just opened a big file and said, Mr. Dickinson, I have here a letter that says you have head and neck cancer. I went, so that's how they tell you.
And that is how they told you?
Yeah.
There was no preparation. There was no trying to.
I knew anyway because you know they'd taken a little biopsy of the lump in the side of my neck, which was a secondary tumor, and they said, you know, you have squamous cell carcinoma in your cells in your lymph node. And I went, well, carcinoma, that's cancerous, you know. So I was under no illusions that there was something wrong. This is a staggeringly common cancer. It's one that's not talked about, you know, mainly because Michael Douglas talked about it and everybody sort of went, you know. But actually, I've met so many men who've had this cancer and have all come out of it fine. Men who've had it 15 years ago, men who've had it 25 years ago, guys who've had it 3 years ago. And everybody from diplomats to pilots, to rock stars, to, you know, people who work in the corner shop, doesn't discriminate, you know.
Let's go back to talking about your musical career, because I've always had the inkling that you're not a man to be messed with, Bruce. And I was looking at some YouTube videos. Don't worry, don't be getting nervous. In terms of, you like people to behave in a certain way, as in, like, gentlemen at times. Have a listen to this clip from a couple of your concerts.
Restrained by a couple of very friendly fans, just calm down, all right, will you? Otherwise you will be exiting. Pick a window. Normal service will be resumed as soon as possible. Play on.
I love that. In the middle of a concert, thousands and thousands of people, and if you really are paying incredible attention to the people that are there to see you, to the point where you can see people are misbehaving, and you're not afraid to say, stop the music for a moment, or I'll stop singing, you sort yourself out or get out.
You've got to look after people, you know. I mean, the people turn up to a show and you kind of have to hold, as far as possible anyway, you have to try and hold the space that they're in to make it safe for them, you know? I mean, the whole idea is, unlike the Doors, you know, everybody gets out of here alive. And I don't know why people decide to behave like complete psychotic knuckleheads, possibly because they are. But every now and again, you get one or two down at shows. I mean, if people are just drunk and, like, woozy, you know, but then it's one thing. But I think in the US, with the availability of certain drugs, you get people and they take some weird stuff and then they start getting really a bit strange. You have to get them out because it poisons the whole atmosphere. People just getting rowdy and having fun and everything. Yeah, that's completely different. And you can tell the body language is different. You know, yeah, you'd be fierce and passionate and celebrating everything and, yeah, being, and you know, jump over the barrier and enthusiasm and everything. I think, great, yeah, whatever, you know, terrific. But having people just come along who just decide to just thump people and stuff.
It's also a lesson if you think you're in a concert and the people on the stage, they can't really see you or what you're doing. It's too dark out there. If you're at a Bruce Dickinson concert, that is definitely not the case. Just because we're a bit pushed for time, Bruce, and I want to ask you a bit about flying. You have done flying commercial jets for quite a while. You even piloted Maiden Around the World in terms of the tours there. Where did that interest come from? Because it's not the most usual, I say pastime, but it's a career as well.
It's very strange, you know, because there's quite a lot of synergy. There's a word for you, hey, between musicians and flying. And it cuts both ways. There's an awful lot of pilots I know who play, you know, guitar and drums and things like that. And there's an awful lot of musicians I know who ended up as pilots. You know, everybody from, you know, Tom Cruise to myself and Nico McBrain and, you know. So there's something about it. And I think it's that it's a three-dimensional medium. outside and also three dimensions inside. Flying's a very personal experience. You know, it's hard to share it with people that don't share the same passion, you know.
What's it like, though, to, because I've never asked a pilot this before, to be in command of this huge multi-million pound machine and people's lives, you know, depend on you doing your job and doing it properly?
Well, first of all, being in command of this huge multi-million dollar machine is absolutely, first of all, it's brilliant. When you turn up for work and you just stand there underneath this huge, incredibly powerful machine, and you go, they've lent that to me for the day, and all I've got to do is return it in good nick, you know. It's a privilege, it really is. The bit about the safety of all those people in the back, there's two elements to that. One is making decisions about things that happen on the ground. And that's a big part of it. And that's basically management. That's kind of management slash risk management. That's all kinds of things, you know, whether it's, you know, this woman is pregnant and can you take her, or somebody's ill, or, you know, should they be on the flight, or as I've had to do on occasions, not very often, but, you know, chuck somebody off for being, you know, if you start off the flight, you know, that drunk, it's not going to get better, is it? You know, so things like that. Once you actually shut the doors, everybody's sitting down, we take off, then my survival is basically their survival. And bear in mind that in most, if ever there's going to be a crash, you know, I'm afraid I'm going to be the first one that feels the thump, because I'm right at the front. So as far as I'm concerned, my job is to get the airplane, if anything happens to it, God forbid, my safety and the crew and the passenger's safety is inextricably bound up. You know, I mean, if the engine goes bang, frankly, as long as I land the airplane, stop it, and everything is hunky dory, everybody walks away.
We're almost out of time. When it comes to Iron Maiden, I think even people that weren't huge fans over the years will know of it. It's very iconic. You've got the likes of Eddie the Head, your mascot. If I'm totally honest, he used to freak me out when I was a child.
It's going to get even scarier now, because we just been I find these things out on press releases. We're now a character in Angry Birds.
Yes, I saw that.
how wild is that?
Well, that's one of the iconic things about Maiden is Eddie, yourselves, your hair. You know, for quite a while, it was like some very early L'Oreal adverts, if you don't mind me saying. Was there a lot of effort put into that?
None whatsoever.
You're a liar.
No,
And then I looked through the book and I looked at a couple of pictures. Now, this, because it's morning, I need to be very careful how I explain. The first picture I looked at when I opened it, you're wearing a pair of what looks like red PVC or leather trousers, and that's...
Are you talking about the fruit and veg shot?
Yes, fruit and veg. Now, I want you this morning to use your imagination when we talk about the fruit and veg shot. How uncomfortable was that, those trousers and those outfits that you used to wear?
I have to say, they're very comfortable, because it actually didn't feel like you were wearing anything. And if you look very closely, it doesn't look like you're wearing anything.
Oh, yes. That's the meat and veg. And fruit and vegetable. I need to get this right, or we'll have to cut this all out. And then I flick to another image, and it's of you in front of what, I don't know how many it is, but it looks like tens of thousands of people in a huge arena. And you're standing there with your arms held high. And I just wonder, what does that feel like to stand there? People are there to see you, your band, and to hear you sing. It's your own personal thing, your own performance.
The most bizarre thing about that is that you, I look at those pictures and I go, "Caw, look at that." And that's exactly what I didn't think at the time. Because at the time, you're so in it. If you sort of took the time out to stand there and sort of admire yourself standing in front of all those people going, "Wow, look at this moment," then the crowd deserve to eat you alive, because you're not doing what you should be doing, which is entertaining them.
It's been a real delight to talk to you this morning, Bruce. Thank you very much. The book, which is called What Does This Button Do? is available, and I really appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
That's great. I hope you enjoy it.